missed tears go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames.
What is up, Wisconsin? I am Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to the Civic Media Network. Welcome, everybody. It is Tuesday, and we have some special shows for you planned. Pete Schwava is going to be live tonight in Madison at the Minocqua Brewing Company from 7 to 9 p.m. You can tune in or head on over to the tap room to check out Pete live and in person. That's going to be a lot of fun. If you haven't checked out Pete's show, you're going to definitely want to do that. It's a lot of fun. I think I've got an appearance coming up with Pete sometime in late May. I'm always happy to have a chit-chat about all things pop culture, film, music, and television with Pete. So go check him out tonight live at the Madison Tap Room of the Minocqua Brewing Company. Again, that's 7 to 9 p.m. And you will not want to miss our special coverage of Joe Biden, who is going to be in Racine tomorrow. We're not exactly sure when he's going to be speaking, but we're going to have special coverage by my colleagues, Jane Matinair, Matinair on Air from 10 to 12, and the Todd Alba Show from noon to 2. So don't miss Joe Biden tomorrow. But really excited to kick off today to be joined by an old friend and someone that I used to work with a lot in my past job as County Corporation Counsel, to help the most important Fourth Estate, our journalists who help hold local government accountable and help everybody get greater transparency on whether or not local government officials are delivering for taxpayers and residents. Journal Sentinel reporter Mary Spicuzza, thanks so much for making time this afternoon, Mary.
Thanks for having me. And you thought you'd gotten rid of me.
Oh, hardly. I hope not. Again, It is a challenging time. I was at the Gridiron Dinner, which is kind of like the White House Correspondents' Dinner for journalists in Milwaukee on Friday. And it was just a very clear reminder that we need local news and we need local journalists like yourself. So again, thank you for everything you do, Mary.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry I missed the dinner.
Oh, next year we'll yes. see you there and quaff a few beverages, maybe before that too, as the weather improves here. So much going on. Some breaking news yesterday. If you haven't heard yet, the longtime City of Milwaukee elections chief Claire Woodall has been replaced by Mayor Cavalier Johnson. This was really surprising to me, Mary. Tell us what we know about Mayor Johnson's move to replace former elections director Claire Woodall.
I don't know if you've heard, but there's an election coming up in November. That's kind of a big deal. So there's that. It's 6 months before a major presidential election. And I know he said there wouldn't be big shakeups, but I think most people feel shaken up by this. You know, clearly she's been in the position for a while. She replaced Neil Albrecht, who was a longtime veteran elections official. I think definitely she was mentored by him. And I don't think that a lot of people outside City Hall saw this coming. I think that it will be interesting to see that her deputy will be replacing her, it looks like. This is not a seasoned veteran seasoned election official. I think she started in 2023, I want to say. So certainly trial by fire for her. I think we'll be watching to see if the city decides to bring back somebody like a Neil Albrecht or a veteran person on maybe a contract basis to help out, because this is such a major election. And as we've seen, a lot of attention will likely be on Milwaukee and the ballots and when the absentee ballots are counted. And I think that, you know, this election's obviously a big deal.
Yes, the mayor announcing that Claire Woodall's deputy, Paulina Gutierrez, will take over, at least as acting election commissioner. As of right now, Gutierrez, again, did come to the election commission in early 2023 after the 2022 midterm election. So to be perfectly frank, unless I'm reading this wrong, Mary, Ms. Gutierrez has never actually overseen or been part of the election commission for even one election cycle.
For like a major election, you know, there are the spring elections, the primaries, things like that. But yeah, for a, you know, major presidential election here, no.
I thought some of the correspondence and the mayor's comments were interesting. Let me read to you, and I'd just like to get your impressions here. Again, this is Gutierrez writing to her staff on Sunday evening. Change, especially when it is unexpected, can often be unsettling. The experience of changing leadership is demanding and uncertain as we navigate uncharted waters and relearn to collaborate and communicate as an organization. Gutierrez wrote further that she is building a network of people with experience in elections to support our efforts in this upcoming critical election year. The mayor has assured me that we will be provided with the appropriate resources as we move into the fall to ensure our success. Interesting language, is it not?
Yeah, a few things. You know, obviously, as a reporter, when you see her saying it's unexpected, it makes you think that it wasn't just people outside the office that were caught off guard, but that people in the office also didn't expect it. So there's that. And then about relearning to like communicate or work together, I guess it raises questions of, was that not happening in the office? So I'm sure we'll be doing some records requests. I know Allison Durr is a extremely hardworking reporter, and we've been talking about some possible follow-ups and things to look into. But it does raise some questions about people in the office. It sounds like they were also caught off guard about relearning how to collaborate. What was going on there? Were they not collaborating? So it did raise some questions. And I saw that, I think it was Matt Smith who interviewed Mayor Johnson. Yes. As well. And that also was an interesting interview. So I'm afraid I have more questions than answers at this point, but we'll be working on it and we can keep you posted.
Yes. I'd love to have you and or Allison back as you learn more. Yes. Some of the comments that the mayor made to WISN TV's Matt Smith was that Woodall was offered a different position within the city. She declined to take it as of now. That in and of itself, interesting. And when asked what the basis for the change was, the mayor responded that it's more of a personnel matter as opposed to a matter of her technical ability to do her job. She's great as a technical performer. He denied that she was fired. And when asked if she had been accused of any wrongdoing, the mayor responded, quote, not if you're insinuating actions similar to her former deputy, Kimberly Zapata, end quote. And then when asked to elaborate, the mayor responded, I'm not going to go into some of the personnel decisions. I'll just say this, that these are my words. This is my commentary, not yours, Mary. It seems to me that there was some sort of personnel or chemistry or leadership sort of set of issues that led to the change. Notwithstanding that, I still think it's pretty gosh darn shocking. 6 months away from maybe the most important election in modern American history. And certainly, Ms. Woodall was around. I worked with her as County Corporation Counsel during the 2020 cycle and the challenges that came from that and just the operation, the operational components of running a recount. This seems strange. Anybody heard anything from former Elections Commissioner Neil Albrecht? Any other buzz around this issue that you all at the Journal Sentinel are hearing?
Well, Neil, if you're listening, call me. Might have left him a voicemail, eagerly waiting by my phone to hear what's up. I think that, you know, if any of us, I was at the recount in 2020 covering it. I think you were there as well.
Oh, yes.
It was an intense scene. Like, it was, I mean, the I think at one point there was a group that was objecting to every ballot that had been folded, which was every mail-in ballot, obviously, yes. Because you have to fold them, get in the envelope. There was a pretty intense gathering around the City of Milwaukee tables and people wanting to get closer. They felt like they should get closer than some of the staffers wanted them to be. And definitely some like tense moments. I'm trying to imagine being new to your job and being thrown into a situation like that. That's not to say there necessarily will be a recount this time around, but there very well could be. Obviously, we know there's a lot of scrutiny on Milwaukee County. You know, obviously there have been false claims about ballot dumps and all sorts of things. And I think that, whoever is running the elections is going to have to be ready for all of it. So I guess time will tell, but it does make you wonder if maybe they will be, if they're on the phone with Neil Albrecht right now, who knows?
Exactly. The mayor's written statement also included this: Paulina's integrity and capabilities are ideally suited to this position. She will lead the office at an important juncture when public scrutiny of the work of the department will be extremely high. I have confidence in her, and I will make certain the department has resources it needs to fulfill its duties. Pretty standard fare, acknowledging the scrutiny, I think, which is to be expected by any reasonable measure. But what I found most notable about the mayor's written statement was that it did not itself acknowledge Ms. Woodall nor thank her for her service. Which, kind of surprising, is that unusual in your experience, Mary?
That, I mean, certainly, obviously when somebody leaves on amicable terms, there is often praise for the predecessor. So,
we gotta leave it there. I'm so sorry, Mary. Yeah. We'll have you back on. Give me a buzz when you hear more, and we'll talk with you and Allison. That's Mary Spacuzza from the Journal Sentinel. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Back with more in just a moment. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Network. My thanks to Mary Spacuzza, my guest last segment, talking about the very shocking news that City of Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson has replaced his elections commissioner, who helped see the City of Milwaukee through that crazy election in 2020, including a recount. Watch this space, more to come. We'll certainly try to bring you that news directly from the reporters breaking it from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Other big news coming from the Journal Sentinel yesterday, also involving Milwaukee. I want to use it to set the table for a broader discussion, however. This particular news that came out yesterday was that Milwaukee County's former medical examiner basically botched an autopsy. And as a result of the frankly, screwed up autopsy, the district attorney's office has dismissed a homicide case. This is reporting by Ashley Lutheran, again, of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The victim here was a 2-month-old baby. You may recall hearing about this in the news, named Kai Ivy. And the autopsy, according to the district attorney, did not meet national standards for investigating sudden infant deaths. As a result, Deputy District Attorney Matthew Torbenson dismissed the homicide charge he had filed against the baby's father, 23-year-old Jacob Ivy, last month. The former medical examiner, Milwaukee County, Brian Peterson, has been the subject of I would argue, an incredible amount of controversy for a position that typically isn't subject to that much controversy. You may recall that Peterson left his job unexpectedly, circumstances still unknown, and his retirement was then succeeded by his failure to testify in a number of major cases. And that is quite unusual. Typically, even when a medical examiner testifies, if he or she had led an autopsy, especially on major homicide cases, it is the ordinary course of business that that now retired or moved on to a different position, that the chief medical examiner would come back to testify, especially if he or she was the one that actually did the autopsy for the case at issue. Peterson refused to do so on a number of cases. Perhaps most notably was the homicide trial of former Milwaukee police officer Michael Mattioli, who was ultimately acquitted by a jury. Now, returning to the Kai Ivey case, after Peterson's retirement, again, refusing to testify in cases, the new medical examiner, Dr. Tolomak, reviewed the file for the Ivy case and was asked to provide an independent opinion, presumably so she could likely testify in the Ivy homicide case. However, Dr. Tolomak, again, this is according to reporting by the Journal Sentinel, Dr. Tolomak could not do so in part because too little tissue had been preserved by Dr. Peterson to permit retesting. Again, the Journal Sentinel reporting, they reached out to Dr. Peterson. He did not return phone calls or text messages requesting comment about the Ivy case or any of his prior work. Now, what is really interesting here, and when you look at some of the controversy surrounding Dr. Peterson, and I'm going to talk about that a bit more, but in the broader context of medical examiners nationwide and the role that they play and their relationships with law enforcement. And I think what many of us may not know or have exposure to is that there is and can be an incredible amount of subjectivity in the work of a medical examiner. And we're going to talk about where some of that comes into play. And in fact, around the time of the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, who was convicted for the murder of George Floyd, a study was published that explored bias in the medical examiner profession. I'm going to talk about that study at length today. The reason that I think this is so important is that it has been my experience, and I have learned over the years as an attorney, that there is truly something called the law and order effect or the CSI effect. And there are really two things. The law and order effect, when I refer to that, means that most of us in the United States, here in Milwaukee or in Waukesha, broadcasting live from the UK, we tend to presume and credit always, or in most cases, that, you know, we've got Olivia Benson on the case, that we've got a Lenny Briscoe, these very diligent, in all cases, honorable, thorough police that will follow the evidence wherever it leads and will help uncover folks that are wrongly accused, as well as go after the right people. That's kind of gotten baked into our social consciousness. And that is combined, of course, with the CSI effect, which I think of somewhat separately. And that is, the American public expects a lot of forensic evidence and also tends to credit scientific testimony and credit it a lot. And when you talk about a medical examiner who is a typically an ME is a doctor who has a specialty in forensic pathology, when that medical examiner takes the stand, that is unquestionably incredibly powerful testimony. And it would be, I think, challenging in many circumstances for juries to discredit or disregard medical examiner testimony. Now, medical examiners, they have to decide both cause and manner of death. Those are two very different things. The cause of death is usually very well grounded in medical science. And while there, of course, are some exceptions, determining the cause of death typically is not very controversial. Now, there can be mixed causes, contributing causes, all those sorts of things. But again, you're looking typically at very hard scientific, biological evidence within the body to make those determinations. But when you look at manner of death, this is where the subjectivity can come into play. And there's only five manners of death that a medical examiner or a coroner, depending on the jurisdiction, can conclude has occurred. Those five manners of death are suicide, homicide, accident, natural causes, and undetermined if you can't quite figure it out. We're going to take the farm update. I'm going to get back into this because understanding how this scientific testimony plays out in jury trials and the biases that can impact how medical examiners determine especially manner of death is really important for all of us to understand more about. My name is Maggie. You are listening to the Civic Media Network. Don't go anywhere. Your farm update is next, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network, talking about the use of the testimony of medical examiners and criminal trials. I'm talking about the use of other science as well in criminal trials. Because, frankly, this is a complicated subject. And unless you've got something that is absolutely, completely, and totally replicatable, that if you gave it to each one of the scientists of a given specialty, you gave them the evidence that they're looking at, and they all would routinely come up with the exact same answer, that means it ain't totally objective, and you've got some judgment, some subjectivity in how to assess that evidence. And any time we see subjectivity, especially within the law enforcement system, you're going to have bias because we're human beings and we are affected by culture and the way that our brains are wired. And in many instances, when we focus on medical examiners, they're very much part of the law enforcement structure. They work hand in glove with both police and prosecutors. Many medical examiners consider themselves almost to be on the side of both police and prosecutors. At times, police will be in the room when autopsies are conducted, a privilege never given to defense attorneys. So, you know, when you're part of that ecosystem, and these are people that you work with day in and day out, many medical examiners tend to have a bias that does preference law enforcement. Now, I'm not saying every single one of them, of course, and I think most medical examiners, just like most police officers, most prosecutors, attempt every day to do their job in good faith. But the question of bias within the medical examiner profession, just like any profession, is one that I would expect medical examiners to be willing to look into and face with some humility. But as we're going to discuss this half hour, that has not been the case. All of this discussion got queued up because of a story broke yesterday by Ashley Luthern of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel The former medical examiner for Milwaukee County, Brian Peterson, conducted an autopsy on a baby. And that autopsy, according to the current medical examiner, as well as an independent pathologist hired by the defendant's attorney, said that this autopsy conducted by the former medical examiner from Milwaukee County did not meet the standards set by the National Association of Medical Examiners. Here's what the public defender said. Again, the charges against baby Kai Ivy's father, who died at 2 months old, were dismissed by the district attorney on April 19th. Travis Schwantes is the public defender that represented Kai Ivy's father, suggested that if the autopsy had been done correctly in the first place, his client may never have been charged. An outside expert, again, hired by the defense, offered that the baby likely died from a bacterial infection based on the initial lab results that were taken at the hospital. You know, this is the problem, right? If there is bias, or if the autopsy, as was the case here, was just simply not to standard, shoddily done, you have someone that was subjected to 3 years of prosecutorial process, right? That to me is really disturbing. Again, this baby's father was charged died over 3 years ago. His father was charged shortly thereafter. Those charges just dismissed about 3 weeks ago. That's quite a saga. Again, Dr. Peterson, the former medical examiner, in his report noted bleeding in the baby's retina and signs of brain bleeding and traumatic brain injury, according to the criminal complaint. He ruled the cause of death blunt force head injury and concluded the manner of death was homicide. But Jane Turner, a doctor, an outside expert hired by defense counsel for Mr. Ivy, noted Peterson's autopsy did not include microbiology testing as recommended in the standards set by the National Association of Medical Examiners, and that testing could provide detail about what role, if any, infection played in the baby's death. The infant was also not tested for COVID-19 or other respiratory viruses, despite his death occurring during the pandemic. Moreover, the doctor wrote, this is the doctor hired by the defense, that the autopsy was narrowly focused on inflicted head trauma from the outset, and the lack of testing or investigating of strep B as a potential cause showed Peterson's bias, the defense expert wrote. This is what we're dealing with. And what I say by dealing with, every single one of us want experts, especially experts that are involved in criminal prosecutions where you're imprisoning people. We want those experts to be unbiased, to be as objective, to base their opinions on replicatable, tested science. Here's the newsflash. When it comes to manner of death, that is simply a subjective judgment in many cases. And again, that opens the door to bias. I could spend a week talking about various, what I'm going to call, forensic sciences that have over time been thoroughly questioned or debunked. For example, bite mark scientific evidence has largely been debunked as a reliable method of identifying an assailant. Certain arson burn pattern science also has been thoroughly questioned over time. Exonerations have occurred because of bad, quote, forensic science relating to arson investigations. Witness identification is now largely understood by those both within law enforcement and part of the criminal defense bar to be highly unreliable. If you're witnessing something that is traumatic, either as a victim or a bystander or a witness to that, oftentimes our recollections can be murky, very subject to suggestion. Again, a lot of these, quote, forensic sciences have come under incredible scrutiny, especially since DNA testing has become more widely available and less expensive. If you have questions or comments about this, I definitely invite you to join our conversation, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. I don't want to spend too much time focusing on this, the tragic death of baby Kai Ivey, or on Dr. Peterson or this particular set of facts. I want to pivot this, and I'm going to rely on some work done by reporter Radley Balko for the National Review. This was an article published on November 28th of 2023. It is titled, "How Medical Examiners Shield Violent Cops from Scrutiny." Now, we know now, I think collectively, that there are some police that do engage of constitutional right violating, abusive, and sometimes downright homicidal behavior towards people of color. We know Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. We know that this has happened with, unfortunately, some degree of regularity. What we should be asking ourselves, and what the reporter Radley Balko asks, is, if we understand that determining the manner of death, and again, there's only five manners of death: homicide, suicide, accident, natural causes, or undetermined, that if a medical examiner determines that something was an accident or that death occurred because of natural causes, well, that would pretty much bring an investigation and a possible prosecution of an alleged assailant, be she a police officer or not, to a stop. Only if a medical examiner determines that the manner of death is homicide does an investigation, a law enforcement investigation, proceed and continue. This is, of course, also true when the subjects of the investigation are police officers. So again, understanding and acknowledging if there is some kind of bias that operates with medical examiners, as I would humbly offer it operates with each and every one of us because we're human, would seem to be an incredibly important threshold question to start to try to understand, hey, are medical examiners basically cutting off at the knees investigations into potential bad actor police officers? Radley Balko's coverage, again, this is for the New Republic, came out November 28th of last year, begins with an example of this. In the summer of 2021, the body of 29-year-old Damian Cameron was delivered to a crime lab in Jackson, Mississippi. Cameron, a black man, had died after a struggle with police. His face was swollen and bloodied, and there was bleeding in his neck. Witnesses described seeing two deputies kneeling on Cameron for more than 10 minutes, certainly reminiscent of George Floyd's murder. Yet Stacy Turner, the state's medical examiner, ruled Cameron's manner of death to be, quote, undetermined. That decision effectively headed off any further investigation and the officers returned to work. 2 years later, Rankin County Deputy Hunter Elward, one of the officers who had knelt on Cameron, pleaded guilty to charges in another case, the horrific torture of black men. Elward and a gang of his fellow deputies, who called themselves the Goon Squad, admitted to breaking into the men's home, torturing and sexually humiliating them, then sticking a gun into the mouth of one of the men, at which point one of the deputies claimed it mistakenly fired, leaving the man with severe and disfiguring injuries. I have talked about the Goon Squad on my show before. The point that Radley Balko is making is that if the medical examiner had concluded that Mr. Cameron, that his manner of death was a homicide, that would have triggered an investigation into Hunter Elward, one of the Goon Squad, who went on to commit what is, by any account, a just horrific violation of a citizen's constitutional and civil rights. When it comes to in-custody deaths, or when police are interacting with citizens or residents, a faulty manner of death determination, again, will stop an investigation into potential police misconduct. Now, here's what we now know. Back in 2020, a couple of months before Derek Chauvin's trial began, a team of researchers led by London-based cognitive neurologist Etiel Dror, they published a study in the Journal of Forensic Sciences. This blew the lid off this question of potential bias among medical examiners. Dror and his team asked 133 medical examiners to review an autopsy report of a child's death and to determine if the manner of death was accidental, a homicide, or if there was insufficient information to make a determination. Now, the participants were given identical autopsy reports except for these facts. Half were told that the deceased child was black and had died while in the care of the mother's boyfriend. The other half were told the child was white and had been in the care of a grandmother. Now, these facts should be absolutely irrelevant to a determination about the manner of death. But when we return, I'm going to tell you what this study concluded, as well as two subsequent studies into medical examiner bias that this researcher and his team of researchers have conducted since 2020. You're not going to want to miss this. It is important information for every single one of us to understand and incorporate into our understanding of how our legal system works. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. If you want to join our conversation, you can do so 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
I'm only happy when it rains. I'm only happy when it's complicated. And though I know you can't appreciate it, I'm only happy when it rains. You know I love it when the music.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. We're talking about the use of forensic science in our legal system. And frankly, some of the biases that have been brought to light in the last few years. A team of researchers led by a cognitive neurologist out of London, Dr. Dror, published a study in the Journal of Forensic Sciences that basically found that medical examiners suffer from a pretty significant bias. Now, in this study I described right before we took a couple of messages, was that half of nearly 150 medical examiners were given the exact same autopsy file, and again, all of them same autopsy file, but half given the file with just one descriptor that was different. One half were told that the victim in that case was a black child that had died while in the care of the mother's boyfriend. The other half were told that the child was white and had been in the care of the mother's mother or the grandmother. The medical examiner's results were astounding. Those medical examiners with the file that indicated it was a black child were five times more likely to rule that the death was a homicide than those with the file of the white child. Wow. Now, if I was a medical examiner, what I would be thinking to myself is, well, what are we going to do to help ensure, what are the procedural or process improvements to ensure that we are not engaging in bias, especially since in many circumstances, medical examiners are really part of the law enforcement ecosystem, working hand in glove with prosecutors and law enforcement. How do we prevent this? You would think that that would be the professional response from a group of scientific professionals to this study published by Dr. Dror. But that was not what happened. What happened was that the backlash across the forensic pathology specialty and science was incredible, harsh, personal, and vitriolic. These were personal attacks and professional attacks. Over 8 complaints were filed with the authors of the studies. Again, independent review of those studies was conducted by the journal. No evidence of data tampering or any other professional impropriety found with the studies. These folks were vilified up and down by forensic pathologists. And I will have to note that one of the most vocal critics of that study was former Milwaukee County Medical Examiner Brian Peterson. His criticisms were noted at the time, as was an incredibly bizarre statement that he made to the listserv of the National Association of Medical Examiners. Dr. Peterson, in response to the study, wrote this: "Is there anyone in our profession that has not, at one point or another, quipped about spinning the wheel of death and picking one?" I don't know about you, but that kind of attitude from a medical examiner when a determination of homicide versus accident versus undetermined can potentially send people to prison for the rest of their natural born lives seems to me to be a bit out of place. I'll also note that Dr. Peterson went on to be a consulting expert for Derek Chauvin's defense team. Wow. Don't know if you knew that, but yeah, a little shocking. Now, one of the things that I wanted to know was, is this a problem in other countries that have medical examiners? And it turns out it's not. We're the only country in the developed world in which medical examiners are asked to testify in court about the manner of death. In other words, in other legal systems, that determination will be made, but the person who makes the determination doesn't testify. And therefore, again, this crediting of a scientific expert by juries, that impact is lessened because the doctor is not on the stand. Now, in some jurisdictions, medical examiners are actually paid by law enforcement to conduct the autopsy. And in some, they're actually paid bonuses when there are convictions. Again, this is not what I would call the harbingers of independence. Even where that's not the case, of course, we still run into the circumstance, the question about, again, that intimate relationship between prosecutors, district attorneys, and medical examiners. Judy Melnick is a medical examiner and was one of the co-authors of this study that I've shared with you. She wrote an article for MedPage Today. In it, she said this, quote, "There is a subset of prosecutors who believe and will not be dissuaded that the investigative work done by a medical examiner always ought to align with the goals of law enforcement, and some forensic pathologists feel the same way." Again, to me, that is pretty shocking. Joy Carter, another co-author of that study, had this to say, that there is a pattern with in-custody death. That is, people that die in the custody of police. There's a knee-jerk desire by medical examiners and forensic pathologists to quickly clear these police officers. Some medical examiners will bend over backwards to blame these deaths on race-based conditions like sickle cell trait or, quote, excited delirium. This, over time, conditions law enforcement officers to be more aggressive with Black people. Now, keep in mind this concept of excited delirium, because I'm going to talk about that more. Excited delirium. I don't know about you, Calvin, but excited delirium. I don't remember hearing about that anywhere else. My doctor has never looked at me and said, well, you're suffering from excited delirium. I've even had a little bit of therapy in my life. My therapist never looked at me and said, Maggie, you're suffering from excited delirium. So where the heck did that come from? I also want to share with y'all some of the additional studies conducted by Dr. Dror after the publication of the 2020 study. We're going to hit the top of the hour, you're going to hear news, weather, and sports. I'm going to bring on a very special guest, but I am going to come back to this discussion. It is so important that we understand how our legal system operates, and perhaps this role of the medical examiner simply cannot be overestimated. Don't go anywhere. Again, your news, weather, and sports are up next. Got a really special guest coming up for you. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.